Hi guys, my name's Yuan Day and I'm on the Dope Science Show this week with Stephanie. I'm super excited to be talking about science and I hope you tune in.
Yeah, can't wait for you guys to listen.
Hello, welcome to the Dope Science Show with Stephanie Lowe, aka Science Steph with Steph. Thank you for your ears and minds. I hope that the show sparks new ideas, new opportunities, and conversations. I want us to learn and grow. We are all curious, innovative, and experimental in our daily lives. We are all dope scientists.
Hello, you guys. Welcome to the Dope Science Show. This is Stephanie, aka Science Steph with Steph, and I'm here with an awesome, awesome scientist named Yuan Day. Hey, what's up, Yuan Day?
Hi, Stephanie. Hi. Thanks for having me on your show.
Yes. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I've been looking forward to this ever since I found you on Instagram. I'm not sure how I found you. Were you on another science communicators like page?
I don't know. Do you know, I think I might have found you. I think you popped up on the science community or something.
Yeah, okay.
And I saw you and I was like, she looks great. Gonna follow her.
Oh, cool. And then I was like, hey, who are you? And then I was like, oh, I want to know this girl. Because I read an article, I forgot what you were writing about, but it was a science article you had written. Do you, like, maintain, well, you guys are going straight into it, but let me tell you, I'm going to read her bio so we can have a little idea of who I'm talking to. I just get carried away. So your Yuan Day is, her bio is dope. She's from London. She lives in L.A. She's a neuroscientist, a writer, a TEDMed research scholar, and lover of music. I do see you have some music like sets. Do you DJ or what is this?
I wish I could DJ. I can't mix, but I do. I have started making a series of playlists. They're on SoundCloud. They're called No Wahala, which is, I'm Nigerian, and Wahala in Yoruba means troubles. So no hello is I don't want any like troubles. So the playlists are just like 15 tracks. I do them like monthly and it's just music that I like and anyone else who likes the same thing might be into. But yeah, and I love music a lot.
Oh wow, that's super awesome. I wish I did that. I'm so random. You're very organized. So I'm like, I'll just like something and I'll add it to like my happy list in SoundCloud.
That sounds good. That's basically what I'm, it's the same thing.
And you're also a lover of dance. So you dance as well?
I danced when I was younger. I don't actually dance, but I like to dance. So I go to a lot of nights and go and see DJs and music that I like, and I'll dance the night away. I love dancing, and that just comes hand in hand with loving music, I guess.
Yeah. Do you have like a particular dance, like style or music that you really like to get out to?
Oh, that's a hard question. It's kind of a mix. I think in London, I was really spoiled for music because there are so many underground music scenes, and eventually it becomes a bit of a Venn diagram. Like all of them overlap, and it creates this nice community, and it's about that and the dance. But like house music, like kind of Chicago house, Detroit house, that kind of house music. I was a huge fan of when I was in London, and now I've moved over to LA. I'm finding a whole new sort of like ballet funk and Afrobeat's really popular at the moment. So there are lots of good nights where the DJs play that sort of music specifically,
cool.
Which I really like. So yeah, I really love Afrobeat, dancehall, house. Yeah, a whole mix. I like it all.
I love that same kind of music. Where I'm asking this for my personal, like, selfish self. Like, where do you, like, to listen to Afrobeats and stuff? Because every time I go to L.A., I'm always, like, looking for, like, a really cool place to hang out and dance, you know?
Oh, my goodness. When you come, we should go somewhere. I'm still working it out. I find with what I'm... what I miss is sort of those places, those venues that you can rely on that will always have a good night. I think Zebulon is a fail-safe. There's always good stuff going on there. So that's somewhere that I found. But other than that, I feel like there's a lot of sort of one-off, sort of in a warehouse venue somewhere, and it will be a particular night that kind of isn't at a fixed venue. And there are a few good nights in LA, I think. But yeah, I'm still trying to find sort of, you know, a fixed location where you can always go. But yeah, I'd say Zebulon is pretty good. That's in LA.
Know.
Yeah.
Definitely. I'm going to take you up on that.
I'm going to take you home. It'll be fun.
So, you're in LA now, but you're from London. Like, what brought you to LA?
It's quite a serendipitous story. I love film, and lots of film happens in LA. I've always had this romantic idea of it and always been really obsessed with the light, you know, that twilight, orangey, the pastel colors. I've just always just been so attracted to it. So when I was writing up my PhD thesis, as a treat, on a whim, I booked a ticket to LA for when I handed in, and that was my motivation. So I came to LA on holiday, and while I was here, I thought maybe I should just look into a few labs and see if there are any postdocs available. So I had done a little bit of groundwork before. I'd asked my supervisor about a particular researcher who I was interested in the work that they did. So when I came, I basically hit them up and asked them if I could come and look around the lab. And so I did that when I was here on holiday, and then it turned out that they did have funding for a project. So I had an interview, and then they offered me the job, and I obviously was like, yes. So
like,
the visa process,
yeah.
I think so, but the visa process took a while. So it was like three. I went back to London and had to wait for my visa, and then eventually I ended up in LA. But it was really perfect because what I work on is so specific. I work on rare childhood diseases, and I had done my PhD in gene therapy, and that's basically this. Yeah, it just worked out really well. So yeah, that's why I came to LA. So I've got I'm doing a project at the moment that I've been working on for a couple of years, and I think we've got another year of funding, and then hopefully we'll get more so I can carry on.
That's awesome. You mentioned that you had your PhD. So I'm looking at your bio, and it says you had your PhD in neuroscience. Like, what made you pick neuroscience, and why did you get a PhD?
I was thinking about this because I wondered if you'd ask me. I feel like with science, it's like my career in science has basically just been a series of, like, metaphorically speaking, like slightly opening doors a little bit and just seeing what's behind them, because I didn't ever really plan on, I didn't really see myself doing a PhD, because for me that just seemed like such an overwhelming idea, and I just didn't think academia would be for me. But I think the turning point was that I did my undergrad in human sciences. And at the time, I thought I wanted to do medicine, and later worked out that it's not what I wanted to do. But I wasn't really done learning. I wanted to study. I took a couple of years off after I finished my undergrad. And then I was doing like a really... It's quite a boring 9-to-5 job at a university, and I was just sort of looking at my university's website, and I hadn't done much neuroscience on my undergrad, but I read the course description, and I saw that it was actually the deadline for the application was in a few days, and I just thought, I'm just going to apply for it, and so I did, and then luckily I got a position, I got a place on the course, and then that's what changed everything. Like, doing the master's in neuroscience, it was one of the best years of my life. It was so interesting, and all of the lecturers we had were all so inspiring, and the way the course was designed, it was just so bored. So there's something in there for everyone, I think. So I went into it wanting to have more of a psychology sort of, I was interested in, because I'd done a lot of biology, I wanted to sort of try psychology, and there was that in it. And I think when I did my master's, I was sort of sold on the idea of neuroscience, but it took me a few years to work out that I wanted to do a PhD. So actually after my master's, I did a research assistant job for 2 years, which I'd really recommend before anyone decides to do a PhD, because it's pretty horrific. It's really hard.
Yeah.
It's really, really, really hard. And I'm not sure I would be that quick to recommend it for anyone. But I, after working in research for 2 years, I was ready to do it. I thought, okay, I think I've gone as far as I can in this job, and I really want to carry on. So, yeah, it was a gentle, you know, transition to a PhD.
It's funny you said that it's, like, hard, because I follow, like, all these scientists on Twitter, and there's, like, everyone talks about getting their PhD, and they're like, why is it torture? Like, why does it have to be so torturous? And one of the things that, did you have a mentor who helped guide you through the process?
That's a really great question. I agree with everyone on Twitter. It's really hard to describe what it's very isolating, because it's you and your project. And if it goes wrong, if an experiment doesn't work, it's ultimately on you. I mean, you have a supervisor, but you're the one who has to put in the extra hours to fix it. So it's quite a lonely experience, because it's only you really who cares about this very specific tiny thing that you might be working on. I think what got me through was I had a really good friend who was also doing a PhD in the same lab. We became friends through doing our PhD. So you always have, well, at least in my lab, there was one PhD student per year. So at any point there were three or four PhD students, because it's a four-year PhD program. And I happened to be doing mine alongside a very good friend of mine, Helen, and we were so silly, and we would laugh all the time, and we found humor in everything, and that really helped having a close friend doing it with you. And we would like go on, yeah, I was so lucky, and we would go on runs at lunchtime, or we would go for dinner out. So we kind of just kept each other going. As for a mentor, we had a really good system at King's. So I went to King's College London, and you had a personal supervisor, which I think is the case for most places, and you meet with them and you just talk about everything. So that really helps. I feel like they're aware at the university of how difficult it is, so there are those systems in place, but really having a friend going through it, and then also having a wider circle of support, like my friends, my family, really help. But even with all of that, I do have to say that I was really close to quitting several times, because it was just really hard. But I didn't, so it's okay.
You didn't. Obviously, it was awesome. And I wonder, like, was it like every single time you felt close to quitting, was it like, how would you extend it? Like, would you tell yourself, like, one more day? Just, like, one more day.
Gosh, it gets long. I think the first year is fun, because you have to work out what your project really is. So the first year is fun. And then the second and third year is just, you're so lost, because you don't know what your results are going to be, and often they don't work out how you want them to be. And so I think you kind of just get, to be honest, in the middle, you just get lost, and you can never imagine it ending. And I remember a lot, whenever I would talk to friends or family about it, they'd always say, it's going to be worth it in the end, and you just can't see the end. So I think at the actual end, when you can see it, you get really motivated, and everything suddenly comes together, and it's quite exciting. So that's actually a really good point, because you start to see your story, and you start to see the fruits of your labor. And at the beginning, it's just sort of the concept of doing a PhD, so it's still fun. And I think in the middle, you sort of just get lost in this bubble of time. Like in the middle, I don't really remember how fast or slow time passed. And you do maintain balance, and like you're doing a PhD for the longest time. And I remember it was really fun. I'd always see friends or acquaintances, and they'd say, sort of, have you finished yet? And for the longest time, the answer is always no. Like, no, I'm still doing it. And I think in the middle there, it's not really, it's something you're doing. You can't really see the end, but you also have your balance in your life. So it's not just about your PhD. You've got your hobbies and you've got your life as well. So, yeah, I think if that answers it, yeah, in the middle, it's hard to say, but at the beginning and the end, it's definitely about something tangible that you're going to be able to show for it.
Oh, that's awesome. It's kind of like a marathon, but like a lifestyle marathon, you know,
Definitely.
You committed and you're like, okay, like your music, your dancing, your friends, like having a support team and just like you said, making time for yourself to like enjoy life wherever you can, having like, you know, I think it gets you day by day through it. And now that you're here, like, and you're living your life as a scientist with your PhD in LA, is it like everything you hoped for? Like your everyday life, do you feel like you're doing what you had envisioned, or is it even better than you thought?
It's better in many ways because it's different from doing science for a PhD because there's a lot of pressure because you know you have to hand a thesis in at the end. There's also pressure when you're doing a postdoc because you have to meet your milestones for your grant and you need to publish. But you feel a little bit more, there's a bit more flexibility and you feel like you're really doing real science and you're able to follow the path of your data and see where it takes you. Whereas with a PhD, you're always having to worry about, okay, there's a time frame to this, so I can't really go down and explore that route. I have to think about writing up my thesis. So it's a little bit different, and I feel a lot more like I can enjoy it, I think. And so I am, yeah, I'm enjoying it. And it's a new project, so I feel motivated to do it, and it's exciting as well.
That's super cool. It's exciting to me to watch you and people like yourself who are, you know, in the lab doing things that have real-life effects. And I find science to be, like, super exciting because it's the innovation, it's the curiosity, like it feeds, you know, a part of me that that makes me feel good. And I think that's super rewarding as a someone watching scientists learning. And so I was going through your Instagram when I first found you, because I always stalk people's Instagram. I'm not shameful. Like, I'll go back to your first one. But I don't care. Like, 2012, I liked it. I don't care. I saw what you're doing and you're writing, and I just had read this article about what was it? I forgot. It was like stem cells. Oh yeah, they were scientists were able to. I jumped topics, you guys, but scientists were able to document cell development, like, within the first 24 hours. So they were able to, like, track and predict, like, cell development and be able to see, like, a cell take a path towards maybe becoming, say, for instance, it may have become a finger, and then they saw that if something else happens, it might decide, I'm not going to be a finger anymore, on the environment. And I was like, I want to talk to someone who knows about this. So I don't know if you read the article recently, if it's fresh in your mind. Do you remember which one I'm talking about with the zebrafish?
I do. It's awesome. So fascinating. It's such a good article. Yeah, I have read it. And it actually was really interesting for me, and I think anyone who works in this area, because the information is I think it's relevant for all sorts of cell work. So in the paper they're talking about, I think the classic idea of cell development is we all start off as a bunch of stem cells, and then it divides into two and then four and then so on. And then those cells, which have the potential to become anything, become fated in different directions, as you say, and they become like a heart tissue or brain tissue. And I think the idea was that it's sort of like a tree. So once you start going down one path, then you can't really go backwards. And what the research is showing was that that's not the case, and that even when these cells have gone down a particular pathway, they can switch depending on the environment, which is really interesting for what I'm doing, because I'm growing brain cells in a dish, and I've just recently started trying to make 3D structures called brain organoids, which kind of mirror the complexity of the brain, and it's all about development. So research like that is really important, because it helps us to understand actually how development works in the different stages. So I found it super fascinating.
Yeah, I found it super fascinating because I thought, because I'm not going to lie, it was a little bit difficult to read and understand. I got it, but then like reading further in depth, it was a little bit challenging. But reading it a couple of times, I understood. And for the audience, just to give you guys a bit of background, the article that inspired me to reach out to Yawande, and I talked about it and posted about it, it was on other places, but I found it on quantummagazine.org. The article is called Cell by Cell, Scientists Map the Genetic Steps as Eggs Become Animals. And I'll put it in the show notes as well. So basically, in summary, they say for the first time, researchers have traced the genetic programs that guide the development of each cell in early embryos. And they said, surprisingly, even cells that start out different can still end up being the same, which is what we were talking about. Like the cell may go, we thought it would go down one path and say become a finger, and that was it. You couldn't revert and say, I don't want to be a finger anymore. Right. But they're finding out they actually can, and they don't know exactly all the mechanisms, but they are able to collect data in order to have do like predictive math and come up with some sort of algorithm so they can make predictions and come and just experiment with, you know, different scenarios of cell development. And one of the things I thought would be cool is if you can share a little bit about different cell types. When people say stem cells and they say embryonic cells, like, what's the difference? Like, what makes a stem cell special? And are there different types of stem cells?
There are. So stem cells, in short, they need to have two characteristics, basically. So stem cells, they need to be able to, so they're undifferentiated cells, which means that they can form specific cell types. And so to be able to do that, they need to be able to divide, and they need to be able to be pluripotent. So that means that they have the potential to become different cells. So that's the word that we use, so pluripotent stem cells. They have the potential to become different cell types. So why stem cells were controversial is because embryonic stem cells, as the name suggests, they actually come from an embryo. So that's really how we develop as humans. We start off as a cell mass called a blastocyst, and that then develops, that becomes the embryo. And then you have embryonic stem cells. And so the question is, where would you get those from? But I think with a lot of the research that people are doing at the moment is that they use induced pluripotent stem cells. So what they do is, it's really clever, is they basically take a cell that has become differentiated. So differentiated just means it's followed its fate and it's become a particular cell type. So fibroblasts are popular, and fibroblasts make collagen. And so you'd think that, okay, now that's that's that cell type and that's it forever. But actually, by exposing that cell to different factors and messing a little bit with its genetic, its gene expression, you can make it revert back to a stem cell. So everything that it's gone through to become that cell type, it can then go back to a stem cell. And then once it's in a stem cell state, you can then direct it off in a different direction. So for what we want to do is really, really useful to have this technology, because actually we're interested in modeling diseases from patients. So if you can, so for example, if we can take fibroblasts from someone with the disease that we work on, we can take their cells and we can revert them back to stem cells, then we can sort of do all sorts of things, like try and correct the genetic mutation that causes the disease using gene editing technology, which is another big development in stem cell research. And then we can turn it into a brain cell instead, if that makes sense. I'm not sure if that's clear. So you can turn one cell type back into stem cell, and then once it's a stem cell, you can then push it in a different direction and make it into a neuron.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense to me. So, you know, basically with the right, you know, conditions, you can take the cell and make it do anything you want, you know. So,
exactly.
It's super cool because at first we had to start with embryonic cells because that's the technology that we had. But now we don't have to do that in order to get stem cells. You can actually, like, grow them in the lab and do what you want and change them. And one of the things that comes up over and over when I read these articles is RNA and DNA. And I am dyslexic, and I always forget. Like, I can't remember. I'm like, RNA is, like, the messenger, and DNA is, like, and I only know this because I just saw it on your Instagram. And DNA is the blueprint, because I always, like, can't remember. If you were to try to explain to the listeners, like, why is RNA... How is what does RNA do to the cell, and what is and how does DNA relate to a cell? Like, how what are the relationships?
Okay, so DNA, like you correctly described, is it's always described as the blueprint. It's basically a map. So what information? It's like codes, like a code of its DNA is the code for human life and everything we need to build the proteins that we need. Encoded in DNA, which is tightly wound round and like a double helix, which is carried on chromosomes. And so you have the information there, but to get that information out to the rest of the cell, so that's in part of the cell called the nucleus, so it's kind of like the brain of the cell. It's where all of the important stuff happens. So DNA is in the nucleus, and on DNA you have genes. So when people talk about genes for eye color or genes for whatever trait you're interested in, like hair color, that's just a part of that code. So the human genome is all that DNA, and then part of the DNA is a gene. Okay, so you need to get that information out into the cell. So RNA, again, like you said correctly, it is a messenger, but it's really clever because that code is just, it's four letters. RNA can be, it can copy that code and then take it out into the cell in a process called transcription. So that's really the first step of gene expression, which is, okay, here's a map of all the genetic information that you need. Okay, what genes do you want to express? Okay, RNA will go into the nucleus and it will line up alongside that DNA, the gene you're interested in, and it will copy it, and then it can go out into the cell, and then the next step after transcription is translation, where you have proteins which are involved in basically building that information into a protein, and then it's the protein that's the building block. So proteins have different functions, and they're really complex, but that's how you go from DNA to a protein.
Cool. So let me see if I get this. So you have the nucleus,
yeah,
right? Yeah,
say it back to me and see if I was making
sense. And the nucleus is like the brain of the cell, right? That's a good way to think of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what you said. And then within the nucleus, we have the DNA, which is like basically the recipe for, you know, that. It's just like the genetic blueprint or plan. We can say it's like the plan or the list,
yeah,
or the ingredients of the cell or of the organism. And then we have RNA, and RNA can come and copy the DNA, but with a modifier so that it can, like, send a message to create different proteins that create these, that create genes, right? And then the genes are what we see as far as a representation of why you have blue eyes or why you're tall or why you're short or something like that, because those are phenotypes, but... Is that kind of...
that's a really simple way. I want to be careful not to mislead the listeners, because there's also lots of modifications that go on, which is, it's so complex. You have the blueprint, which says, okay, here's the information, but then there are modifications that also happen to those proteins, and that means genes are expressed in different ways sometimes depending on how things are modified down the line. So with RNA, it doesn't actually go into the cell it's not fully formed. It's made up of little building blocks. So I don't know if you remember from like biology. So you've got, they're called bases, and they make up, there's like A, G, C, T, and the order of those building blocks will determine sort of how proteins are then built further down the line. So actually RNA is kind of built using a molecule called an enzyme, which kind of builds up the RNA part by part along the DNA strand. So the DNA is unwound and opened up, and then the building blocks can be built up alongside it according to that code to then make a long RNA strand. So if you think of it like rosary beads, I guess. So each bead is like a building block, and that will be determined by the part of the DNA that you're copying from. So transcription is just copying something. So once those building blocks, which are floating around in the nucleus, and then they're going to be built together to form an RNA molecule, that RNA molecule can then go out into the cell, and then that can then be translated into a protein. So it's just basically copying what's on the DNA to say, okay, this is the information, and then that information can be translated into a protein, which then is for a particular trait.
You know, that's super interesting, because I read that helps me a lot to understand a little bit more, because I simplified in my head, because I'm trying in my head. I'm not in the lab. It's like I want to understand and I want to know all the details, but when I read the articles, just getting the gist of it helps me. But it's really awesome to be able to hear someone who like really understands it and studied it. So thank you for explaining that to me. I'll probably try to listen to it again next time I forget, because I will.
I mean that's the thing. Even the best thing about trying to communicate science, I think, is how telling it is as a science. Because I'm so used to trying to read papers, and by the way, it takes me, I have to read them about 10 times to understand them. We have journal clubs, which is great because it forces you to read the paper and then try to understand it and explain it. But the papers aren't written in a way that are easy to understand. So I think it's hard for scientists to do it anyway. But I think science communication is beneficial for both, you know, for both ways, because even for me, just trying to find a way to explain RNA that isn't in the scientific terms that I've learned it really tests my understanding of it. So it's good. I hope it's clear.
Yeah, it does. It helps me a lot, because I read an article probably a couple of weeks ago about And I'm probably going to butcher this, so I'll put it in the show notes so you guys can read it with your own eyes. But it was an article about sea snails, okay? So the sea snails, what they did, and I'm sorry, it was cruel, but they shocked the sea snails so that they can get them to flinch, you know? And when they would flinch, it was creating this, like, and I'm totally simplifying, you guys. It was creating this, like, I'm going to describe it as like a muscle memory, you know, and it was like a repetitive pattern and reaction that the snail started to do whenever it would be shocked. It would start to flinch when it would be stimulated the same way. And so they took neurons from the snail and put it, those neurons in another snail, right, that had not been shocked. And then they put the stimulus towards the snail that had not been shocked, and it flinched the same as the snail that had been shocked. And then they're like, that's interesting. And they were, go ahead.
No, it's the same. It's really interesting.
Yeah. It might be same as wrong. It might have been RNA that they're using. I think it was RNA, but I'll have to triple check. I'm looking it up as we speak. And then they took they grew neurons in a tray and did the same things with just the neurons from the sea snails. And the exact same thing happened. Like they were able to shock those the neurons and get a reaction. And then they did the same thing. They took RNA from those neurons and put it in the tray with the neurons that didn't, that had not been shocked. And again, the same thing happened. And what was interesting, because then the question came where they were saying, they felt, or I'll have to find the dang article, but it was basically they were thinking that RNA wasn't just a messenger. Like they're thinking the RNA actually has more influence than they had anticipated. So I just think it's interesting. And I'm sorry, I can't speak that more detailed about it because I didn't read the article again today. But I thought it was super interesting.
Yeah, it is really interesting. I think it's so much more complex than I think that we often hear it described. Like even with talking about DNA and RNA, there's like coding and there's non-coding DNA and RNA. Like I just sort of said, oh, there's a code on DNA and then it gets copied into RNA and then it goes out and becomes a protein. But actually there's a lot of non-coding RNA and DNA, which seems to be really important in diseases like, disorders like autism spectrum disorder. Like actually a lot of, I can't remember, maybe I'll send this to you for the show notes, but they're finding that a lot of the differences between people who develop autism and people who don't is actually in the non-coding regions of RNA, which is interesting. And also in terms of comparing different species, we share a lot of our genes that are conserved between different species, but what seems to be different between different species is a lot of that is in the non-coding RNA and DNA. So I think it's really interesting to think about it sort of not just in terms of the classic blueprint, copy it, protein, trait sort of narrative that we hear a lot.
Yeah, like there's definitely more to it. And you were mentioning in your in our emails that you were reading, you said you wanted to talk about mini brains and mice brains. You said a new paper just came out about implanting
mice
brains. Oh my goodness. Tell me about that.
Well, this is so interesting. It's really sort of sci-fi and freaky. So brain organoids. So years and years and years, I think the big question is how to best model disease. So you can do that by using animal models where you've like manipulated their genes to have the the same genetic mutations that humans have, and then you can sort of look at their behavior and sort of look at the tissue and look for differences, and so on. Or you could sort of look at cells specifically in a dish. And so far, a lot of the progress that we've made, and it has been a lot, it's been amazing, has been using sort of 2D structures, so just culturing or like growing brain cells in a dish and looking at like neurons or other cells in the brain, like astrocytes, which are like supportive cells. But that's like really simple. And what we really need is a better model that's more complex. So that's where brain organoids come in, because they actually are 3D structures that resemble the complexity of the brain better. So they're not actually mini brains, but they're more complex, and they tell us a lot about development and how the brain develops. So there have been loads of there have been a number of really important papers about that technology. But the paper that I just read recently was about transplanting organoids, so these little mini brains, into mice brains and seeing if they integrate. Because one of the limitations for mini brains is because you're growing them outside the body in a dish, even though you have this structure which is growing, and it will have come from, like, we're using human stem cells and you're growing like a little mini brain, you're lacking the rest of the environment, like the micro environment, and they often kind of die in the middle. They don't have the right support. So a big question is, what would be the difference if you put that mini brain into an environment where you could have like blood vessels grow? And if blood vessels are growing into the mini brain, then that's going to provide oxygen and nutrients, which is going to support the organoid, and it's going to help it to survive for longer. So in this paper, that's what they do. And so when they drill a little hole, and then they put the organoid into the brain of a mouse, and then they look at, like, I think it's 0.5 months and to 3 months, and the organoid actually develops and integrates into the brain and then becomes vascularized, which means that blood vessels will grow into it and then supply it with oxygen, so it'll grow and it will survive for longer. And it's really interesting, because what I found so, like, unbelievable about it is that neurons form connections with each other. That's how we think. So neurons signal to each other. And they connect to each other via little junctions. So at the end of two neuronal processes, you have something called a synapse, which is just a junction. And the way messages travel along neurons is that they get to the end of the neuron, and then there's like an electrical process that happens that allows the signal to kind of jump to the next neuron. And with these organoids that have been transplanted into the mouse brains, they actually form those connections with the host brain. So the organoids connect to the host brain, and so you have those signals being transferred between the organoid, which is this alien mini brain structure or complex 3D structure made up of neuronal tissue, and the host brain, which is really fascinating, I think.
That is crazy.
It's actually nuts and actually a bit scary.
I'm like, that's super crazy. Well, basically, they like implanted them with like some neural tissues that are, you know, integrating. And it's like, I mean, it's a mouse, but it's like, of course, you want to see. So, what is that going to do? Like, will it change their behavior?
Exactly. So one of the questions they wanted to know is, does it affect the behavior? Because where they implanted it is in a part of the brain that is involved in like episodic memory and navigation and spatial memory. So you want to see what the effects are going to be. So I think this is like in the supplementary data. So they didn't really, I think a lot more research needs to go into it. But they wanted to find out if this affects the behavior of the mice. So what they did is there's this test called the Barnes Maze, which is basically like this big round table with whole like circles all the way around the edge of this bigger circle. And those holes, at the bottom of one of them is like an escape route. So mice don't like being in the middle of spaces. They like to be at the sides. So what they did is that they used visual cues where these holes were. So not all of the holes had an escape route, but one of them did. So the mice, they sort of learned where to go to escape the quickest. And when they compared the mice that had the implants and the mice that didn't, training them to do that, there was no difference. They were both able to learn, okay, there's a yellow, I don't know if they actually used a yellow cube, but let's say it was a yellow cube. So the mice learned, okay, where the yellow cube is, that's where the escape route is. And they learned to go there. But what they found is that when they tested the mice later, so in terms of memory, the ones that hadn't been implanted or hadn't had the organoid graft, they were able to remember where to go to be able to escape, whereas the mice that didn't, they weren't. So they took longer, sort of at all of the other different holes, trying to work out how to escape rather than remembering that, okay, well, it's this hole because I've learned that from the training. So it does have an effect in some ways, but they kind of put that more down to the experimental procedure because if you think about it, I mean, they are drilling a little hole into their brain, so in the area that's involved
Like a lobotomy.
in memory. Yeah, so I mean that's expected. So I don't know if it's the organoid itself that, or just more the procedure, but I thought that was interesting. Yeah, I was just looking at the paper. It was a Nature paper, the first author was Abed Al-Fattah Mansour. I have to double check which university it was, but yeah, it was a Nature paper recently published, and yeah, it's just, I mean, in terms of how science progresses, it's really interesting how you can go from, okay, now we have these things called organoids to the next stage, which is what happens when you implant them, and then it opens up all of this potential because I think one of the things that it could be useful for is that for diseases where you have loss of neurons, one of the ideas is that actually if you implant brain organoids, they could actually help contribute to repairing and rescuing tissue damage. So it could be a potential for brain cell therapy because when we have, there are some neurons which replenish themselves, but for the most part, which is why stroke is so devastating, is once you lose a bunch of neurons, they don't easily regenerate. So that's why this kind of research is quite interesting, I think.
That is super interesting. It's really interesting because, like you said, I mean, as far as a real life application, if you have a stroke, like these have really therapeutic possibilities. My sister, she has epilepsy, and she has seizures regularly. They've gotten better, like maybe once or twice a month, but it's something really close to home for me as far as like the brain and being able to heal the brain and understand the brain.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think there's so much potential in this. It's obviously it's the early days still. But even for like drug screenings, if you have better models, then it means that you're going to be able to sort of get better results at the end of the day. And also kind of, I mean, animal models are almost indispensable in a lot of ways for kind of research into treatments for brain diseases. But I think having another, like an intermediate, like brain organoids definitely is a great tool to have, so you don't have to rely as much, maybe, on animal models. I think that's important too.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it's I don't know if it's more cost effective, but I think you have just more flexibility in what you can do with your research with the organoids. Or at least
Yeah.
that's the impression I've gotten.
Definitely. And also, like, if you think about complex diseases, like if you have a genetic disease that affects one gene and you can knock that gene out in, like, you can manipulate that gene in a mouse, then fine. But with things like schizophrenia or more complex diseases, like, even between patients, there's so much variability in the genetics that it would be much better if you could. And that's why people use cells derived from patients to look at. To carry
I
out
was
this
just about to
research,
ask you
because
that.
yeah, I mean, because then you're actually looking at your specific genetic makeup in a cell. But if it's just, a cell, that's only going to tell you so much. So if you have things like organoids, it means that you can get more answers about development and differences in that way, and how drugs might respond better. I think it's just got a lot of potential for better modeling human diseases.
Very cool. Really cool. Well,
And they're really
I think
cute.
we
They're really
it's super interesting. I feel like we covered everything I wanted to talk about. Was there anything else you wanted to talk about or share with us? Like, you do science communication on, like, where can people find your work?
I write for an online platform called MassiveSci.com, which is really great. They have lots of really interesting articles, and their whole thing is just making science accessible for everyone. And they do it in a really cool way. So they collaborate with illustrators. So visually, it's quite visually delicious, and you want to read about science. And they ask intriguing questions. So I write for them, and I'm working on a few projects at the moment, trying to sort of reach to more platforms for science communication, which I can keep you posted on. But I think Massive is where I write at the moment, and then just my Instagram. I post some videos about what I get up to in the lab. At the moment, I'm on day 10 of an organoid protocol, making these little mini brains. And so, yeah, I post stories about that for anyone who's interested.
Yay! Yeah, I'm
Oh,
subscribing. I'm super excited about that.
yeah.
I'm looking at it now. It is super cool because I just like the format. It's really attractive and the illustrations. It's really cool. I like it. On
Oh, glad.
massiveSci.com. And what's your Instagram name so everyone can follow you? I'll put in the show
Oh,
notes
yeah.
too.
Yeah, it's nice underscore for the memoirs. So NICE underscore FORMEMOIRS. Nice for the memoirs.
Nice. And I always like to have music on the show. I used to make it really hard and have three songs that you had to pick for, but that was too hard
My
to
goodness. Oh,
edit.
that's a lot.
So, how about just one? What's one song you'd like off the top of your head that you'd like to have on the show?
Oh my gosh,
Maybe
one song?
something. Yeah, I know. See, maybe harder.
Oh, okay, let me think. Let me think. Oh gosh, gosh, gosh. Okay, well, because we're both saying that we like Afrobeat, I just found this track called Nothing by a Nigerian artist called Dapo Timburna, and it's a really nice uplifting song, so I would choose that one.
Cool, and I'll message you so you can give it to me, and I'll put it in the show. And
Wicked.
you do the intro for the next show. So the way that goes, and you say, I haven't done this in a while. How do I say it? You say your name, and you say you're on the Dope Science Show, and then you can say listen or check it out, something like that. So for example, you would say, hey, I'm Yawande, and I'm on the Dope Science Show, and I don't know, whatever you want
Okay, so I just have to say, hi, I'm human. Okay, let me try.
Yeah, you could do a couple versions if you like. It's just fun.
Okay, do I do it now? Oh,
Yeah.
okay. Hi, everyone. Hi, everyone. My name's Yuande Pierce, and I am on the Dope Science Show this week. I'm super excited, and I can't wait to talk science with Stephanie.
Awesome. That was a great take. That was great.
Okay, good. Should I try again?
You can do it again. Yeah, sure.
Okay. Hi, guys. My name's Yuan Day, and I'm on the Dope Science Show this week with Stephanie. I'm super excited to be talking about science, and I hope you tune in.
Yeah, can't wait for you guys to listen. Well, that's pretty much the show.
Money come, money go. This life it be like ghost. Steady hustle for the gold. I put my life on the line. I put my life on the line. Anybody want to cool any garden time. They only low any garden time. They only blow any garden time. One day cinnamon go die. They only low any garden time. They only cool any garden time. They only blow any garden time. One day cinnamon go die. Nothing, 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 nothing can stop me from Oluwa blessing. Nothing, 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 nothing can stop me from Oluwa shine. Nothing, 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 nothing can stop me from Oluwa blessing. Nothing, 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 nothing can stop me from Oluwa shine. This life me live no be me get them. When I wake up in the morning I thank Jehovah. Eh. I say get to boy I gas get them. MC Lomo mo de fama. Save money, but the money don't save you. Make money, but the money don't make you. Oluwa lolo, wo eni olono. Oluwa loni, la eni olonko. Lakpa, lakpa, anointing, anointing. Brother man, you see me, I'm shining, shining. Don't let them tell you say easy. If them tell you say easy, I'm gonna set up. You only cool any garden time. You only low any garden time. You only blow any garden time. One day cinnamon go die. You only low any garden time. You only cool any garden time. You only blow any garden time. One day cinnamon go die. Nothing, 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 nothing can stop me from Oluwa blessing. Nothing, 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 nothing can stop me from Oluwa shine. Nothing, 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 nothing can stop me from Oluwa blessing. Nothing, 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 nothing can stop me from Oluwa shine.
Nothing can stop me from Oluwa shine.
Makai, next.
That part to go.